Thank you, Dr. Benson, and thank the elders for this opportunity to give. And I hope that we'll all have the privilege of looking back on this effort today as one of success. Greg Cummins tells in a paper that he wrote of an event of his wife as she was going to an apartment complex one day. And she was walking up the sidewalk to this apartment complex, and there were some little girls playing around on the grounds. And as she walked past them, one little girl said, "Lady, I've got two houses." She stopped and said, "Really?" And the little girl said, "Yes, my mama's house and my daddy's house." And another little girl said, "That's nothing, I've got three houses." Mrs. Cummings said, "You do?" She said, "Yes, my mama's house and my daddy's house and my daddy's girlfriend's house." And then another little girl said, "You know, almost everybody here has two houses." And I read that and I thought of what Jesus said when he said, "Whoever shall cause one of the least of these little ones to stumble, it would be better for that man if he had a millstone hanged around his neck and for him to be thrown into the depths of the sea." When I read things like that, I almost want to cry out, divorce is the most ravaging monster that is attacking our homes today. And yet we'll have to be realistic about it, and though it is a ravaging threat, and though it is something that's destroying home after home after home, and this past year, over 1 million homes were destroyed by divorce. But we'll have to understand that divorce is not really the cause. It's just the effect. Divorce is simply the final burial of a marriage that got sick and refused to get well. You see, homes break down before they break up. And divorce is the breaking up of a home. It's not the breaking down of one. And until we can find out what's breaking down our homes, we'll never find out how to stop breaking them up. So today I want to ask you a simple question. What is the cause of our breakdown in the home today? If you look on the surface and see surface studies and surface surveys, the two most prominent things that are always headlined by the world as causing divorce or the causing of the breakdown are money and sex, or the lack of money and the lack of sexual love. This is the way the world, it seems, always approaches it. And this is the way that the article in the U.S. News and World Report in April the 16th, 1973, I was shocked and a bit dismayed that they had no greater insights to give than to identify the major causes of the breakdown of the home as being money and sex. The world looks at it like this. In fact, the world's definition of incompatible, someone has said that they define it as the fact that he has not enough income and she isn't very patible. And that's about the sum of it. They have no greater insight, it seems, into it than these material outside surface results, but not the causes. These aren't the real causes. They may appear to be in a society that is materialistic, one that's sex-oriented, but these are not the real causes of the breakdown of our home. In Hebrews, the 13th chapter, in verse 4 and verse 5, the writer there gives an insight into the real causes. He mentions both of these surface issues and talks about what the real cause behind them is. "Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. For God will judge the immoral and adulterous. Keep your life free from love of money, and be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." There he talks about these two causes and sets the record straight. We could ask the question, is it a lack of money? And I would say, no, it's not. In the feedback class this morning, a young man said, how much money should a couple have before they get married? How much should they have stashed away? Well, I said, I don't think you have to have any stashed away. If you're in reasonably good health and you've found your mate, I said, don't wait until you stash a big nest egg away. But anyway, this thing of the lack of money is not the real cause. Do you know what the real problem in our homes as it focuses around money is? The real cause, he says here, is failing to be content with what you have, failing to keep ourselves from the love of money. The love of money is ruining many a home because the husband keeps going after it more and more and more each year. And he feels if he doesn't make more money each year than he made the year before, he's backing up. Many times this is not confined just to the husband. He transfers some of this pressure to make money to his wife. Consequently, she goes out and gets her a job, and she starts making more money. And consequently, they leave the children then at home with a babysitter, and the babysitter then profits. The mother and father profit. And you know who pays the bill for all this? The children. But the problem is not keeping ourselves away from the love of money and not being content with what we have. But is it a lack of sexual love? Is that what's causing the problem in our families today? I don't believe so. He mentions here that we ought to give ourselves to looking at marriage in honor. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. For God will judge the immoral and the adulterous. He talks about it here in terms and so much as to say that it ought to be held in a special class by itself. Marriage needs to be set apart in a special class by itself as having or as being worthy of our special honor. I believe that any man and woman who are normal, who are in love enough to marry, are in love enough and are normal enough and are capable enough of providing sufficient sexual gratification for the partner in both giving and receiving to where they neither one need ever to go lacking. I believe that's what God intended for the marriage bed to provide. It needs to be in honor of one another's needs. Paul says in the Corinthian letter, chapter 7, that the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. For the husband, or for the wife, does not rule over her own body. If you want to turn to that passage, I'll wait on you. 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, verses 4 and 5. 3 through 5, really. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not rule over her own body, but the husband does. And the husband does not rule over his own body, but the wife does. Do not refuse one another, except perhaps by agreement temporarily. Now I want you to notice those three qualifying statements. The statement itself is, do not refuse one another. That's a pretty straightforward statement. Do not refuse one another, except perhaps, he says, by agreement, temporarily, while you give yourselves to prayer, and then come back together, lest Satan tempt you by your lack of self-control. I don't know of a more solidly stated injunction in the Scriptures than that. If we will honor each other in the sense of honoring each other's needs, there won't be any lack of sexual love in a family. But a second honor, you must honor each other's role. We studied this last week. The husband's role, we noticed, was to be the initiator and the protector. The wife's role was to simply be the responder. She's to be the gracious responder. And she's to be in subjection to this loving, protective, kind, generous, thoughtful husband. And those are the two roles that we find ourselves cast in. Then there's a third honor. We're to honor God as the originator of marriage. Man didn't originate it. And consequently, man cannot terminate it. He has no more right to terminate it than he has a right to call on it or to claim that he originated the idea of marriage. He didn't do either one. He didn't do the one, he doesn't have the right to do the other. Jesus says that God is the originator. And he says that what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. No man. And that means no woman either. It means no human being has the right to terminate that which God originates. And I'll say this, and I think we need to consider it. that it does not refer here, when Jesus said, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder, this is not just limited to going to the law court to take out a decree of divorce and sue your mate for a divorce. That is not just what he's talking about. Now, it includes that. But the putting asunder of a marriage, do you know how to put asunder a marriage? You put asunder a marriage initially by the foul attitudes and the improper actions that you allow to be yours toward your mate, to where he or she finds himself or herself unable to continue in that kind of a relationship. Whatever you do to erode or to detract from or to unsettle and destroy the foundation of your marriage is this that Jesus is talking about here of putting asunder your marriage. If you were to go into a law court and see somebody standing there with tears in their eyes, taking out an injunction against their husband or suing for divorce, taking out a divorce decree, and then you were to go home and shake your finger at that person and say, that person is going contrary to God's will, and then you go home to your husband or you go home to your wife and you exhibit attitudes and actions toward that mate that makes them then unable to live acceptably with you, then you're as guilty of undermining your marriage as that person is guilty of undermining that marriage. You are putting asunder where God has joined together, and you must not do it. And I think many times this is where we fail. We fail to see that we can become as guilty of undermining and destroying our marriage daily by that dripping of the water or dripping of the acid that eats away at this acceptable relationship that makes marriage possible. So I think you'll have to consider that putting asunder a marriage is not just something that happens in the divorce court. It's something that you contribute toward or contribute to each day. So I don't believe that these two things are actually the main causes for the breakdown in our marriage. I don't believe it's a lack of money, and I don't believe it's a lack of sexual love. We'll have to look somewhere else. I believe that the basic cause for the breakdown in marriage is the character flaws within the people that make up the marriage. Now, people make a marriage. You're going to wake up sometime, as Jimmy said one night in a sermon, he said, you're going to wake up and find that there's somebody in that body, that there's a person in there. You're going to find that that beautiful body that you're courting, that there's a real person in that body. And you girls, as you look for Mr. Super, you're going to find that behind Mr. Super's eyeballs, there's a person lurking back there. And you're going to be scared to death when you find out sometimes just who it is that's lurking behind those eyeballs. Who did you marry? I don't mean the eyeballs, but who did you marry behind the eyeballs? That's one of the most shocking revelations that people have made to them. And it usually happens about, 6 months after you're married? All of a sudden, you see that there's a person in that body. But people make up marriages. And we're not going to make better marriages until we make better people. You're not going to have a better marriage until you become a better person. You're not going to have a better marriage until you learn how to live by yourself. You can't learn to live with someone else until you've first been able to live with yourself. We're going to talk one of these days about the satisfied singles, and it's a very real place in life. Until you've learned to live with yourself, you can't learn to live with other people. But the character flaws. What kind of character is necessary to make a happy marriage? I'll say this before I go further, that I believe that in every marriage that breaks down, every marriage that ends in divorce or breaks down prior to divorce, breaks down because of the lack of Christian character on the part of either one or both partners in that marriage. Let me say it again. I believe that any breakdown of marriage is due to the lack of Christian character on the part of either one or both members of that marriage. I do not believe that two people who are both living according to the Spirit of Jesus Christ will ever divorce each other. I do not believe that they will. Well, what kind of character are we talking about? The beatitude kind of character. I'd like to just translate each one of these with a phrase into marriage language. Let's translate the beatitudes into marriage language. For example, how would you translate blessed are the poor in spirit into marriage language? Well, you translate it by saying, I was wrong. The poor in spirit. That attitude that is humble, That attitude comes out in marriage language as, I was wrong. But look at blessed are the mourners. How does that come out? As you translate blessed are the mourners, it comes translated, I'm sorry, please forgive me. And those are hard words. It's hard to say to your mate, I was wrong. It's hard to say to your mate, please forgive me, I'm so sorry. But then look at blessed are the meek. The blessed are the meek is translated into marriage language as, let's do what's best for you. That I'm willing to forego my rights in order to fill your needs. That's translating blessed are the meek into marriage language. What about blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness? You translate that by saying, we're going to do what's right. We're going to do what God wants regardless. It doesn't matter what we each want. It doesn't matter what we both want. We're going to do what God wants in our marriage. That's what blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness means. What about blessed are the merciful? Blessed are the merciful is translated, I forgive you. I forgive you. It's over. It's past. You don't have to worry about that anymore. I've already forgiven you. It's not like the man that said his wife got hysterical every time they had an argument. Somebody said, you mean hysterical? He says, no, hysterical. She keeps bringing up all those things out of the past. That's not being merciful in your marriage. If you're going to have the Spirit of Christ in your marriage, if you'll have this blessed are the merciful, it'll mean that you'll translate it into being forgiving. What about blessed are the pure in heart? How do you translate that? That translates in trust and confidence to where you say to your mate, I have complete confidence in you. I don't suspect you. I'm not suspicious. I'm not jealous. I have complete confidence that you're doing what you ought to do and that you're being what you ought to be. Blessed are the pure in heart. What about blessed are the peacemakers? Well, that translates, let me be the first to make up. Let me be the first to make up. You know, in most families, by nature, we talk about the man being the initiator. That's right. But by nature, usually one of us is an initiator and the other is a reciprocator. And thank the Lord, he usually lets marriages consist of both initiators and reciprocators in this thing of making up. I don't know how it is in your family. Which of you thinks that you're the initiator and which of you thinks that you're the reciprocator? Now, I ask at the first service if the men would answer for them and their wives and just answer if you men think that you're the initiator in making up and in getting things back on an even keel in your home, would you raise your hand? Well, I saw several women gouge their husband, you know, and they... No, not really. That'd be kind of defeating it. But I'm going to ask you, would you... They didn't do too well. In fact, most of them didn't raise a hand at all. But you know what I'm talking about. And this is nothing bad. In most relationships, there has to be an initiator and a reciprocator. It's when you have just two reciprocators that you have trouble, because she sits over there in sullen silence and he sits over there in sullen silence and neither one of them ever breaks the ice. We've almost got to have an initiator and a reciprocator if you're going to have a happy marriage and a successful home. And I'm going to ask you men, if you'll do the honors, please, if you'll raise your hand, if you are usually the initiator in your making up. I want to see your hands. Raise your hand if you're usually the initiator in making up. Come on now. Raise them high so I can see it. Oh, well, all right. What about you women? Will you men think of your wife now? And if you didn't raise your hand then, will you think about your wife? Is she usually the initiator in your making up? Men, let me see what you say. Well, we've got a lot of stalemates going on then. We would probably get a more objective view if the women raised their hands. Ladies, do you think that you're the initiator? Let me see those who think that you're the initiator. Let me see your hands. We've got some Mexican standoffs. We've got to have some initiators. All right, but anyway, we ought all to grow in initiatory love to where we will be willing to start the thing rolling. If there's some things that have happened, be willing to go to your mate and say, please, I'm sorry. Then blessed are the persecuted. You know how you translate that? You translate that into this. You just simply say, I'm willing to suffer for you. I'm willing to make allowances for your bad days. And you know, wives have bad days. Husbands have bad days. And if the husband and the wife will both have the attitude, I'm going to make up for your bad days. I'm going to make allowances for that. And I'm going to suffer for you. And I'm going to let you have your headache at least in peace. And if we'll do that, we'll be putting into practice what Jesus taught. Blessed are the pure, the meek, all of these things. If you'll translate that into marriage language, your marriage will be on a good beginning and a good continuing. There's another attitude, and that is what Paul mentioned to the Ephesians in Ephesians 5:21, when he says, be subject to one another out of respect for Christ. That's the kind of attitude that's necessary if you're going to have a happy marriage. The beatitude kind, yes. And then this being subject to each other as though it were out of respect for Christ. Now, that just simply means that you answer your mate as though it were Christ asking the question. And that means you speak to your mate as though you were speaking to Jesus Christ. That's all it means. But it does mean that. And if you'll always answer your mate, and if you'll always speak to her in terms as though you were speaking to and answering Jesus Christ, then you won't have any problem. You will be showing respect for each other or be subjecting yourselves to each other out of your respect for Christ. Now, last Sunday, we talked about the male's role and that it was primarily to be that the male was to be the initiator and that the male was to be the protector. All last week, ladies kept coming to me and men saying, when are you going to talk about the lady's role? And I told them this. I said, I don't believe that it's really necessary to go into detail about the woman's role, because once we get the male's role spelled out and identified, the woman will naturally respond to that kind of leadership in the home. And you know, I believe that. I believe that once the women see the male in the family, the man, taking the lead as he ought to in initiating and in protecting, I believe that the woman will almost automatically respond as she ought to as a gracious person. But lest we take something for granted, I want to give you a real brief test, you women. I want to give you what I call a G-test. And in your response to your husband, I want you to grade yourself. If you have a pen, write it in the palm of your hand, because I want you to keep it and look at it occasionally. If you're what we're going to call a 1G woman, that means that you respond to your husband grumbling. You grouch about it and gripe. You're grumbling. Oh, you respond. Oh, yeah, but you grumble about it. And he knows that you grumble. We're going to call you a 1G woman. Would you write it down? We might ought to have the husbands write down their impression of you, too, you know. What's a 2G? A 2G woman, I would call, is one who responds to her husband graciously. Graciously, gracefully. Not grumbling, but gracefully. And a marriage cannot exist on the number 1G. It can exist beautifully on the 2G woman. The 3G woman is the one who responds to her husband with gusto. And you're one of those. You are one of those women. You're either a 1G or a 2G or a 3G. If you're a 3G, your husband will probably be coming back going like this to you, you know. If you're a 2G, he'll be coming by very proudly and thankfully going like that to you. But if you're a 1G, and he feels like he wants to go like this, you know, to you, inside he's wanting to go like this to you. That's right, because you're hurting him. Paul says, do not refuse each other, except perhaps by agreement temporarily. And it ought to be with grace and with gusto. And a marriage can flourish on both of these. Well, you say I'm too old to change. I don't believe that. But you say I'm 45 or 50 years old. I'm just too old to change my ways. I don't believe that. Tom Dyson and Ruth Dyson in Taylorsville, North Carolina, 20 years ago, Tom Dyson was the town alcoholic. He was the town drunk. He was working regularly, but he was a drunk. Ruth Dyson was working in a factory. He was taking care of his money. She was taking care of hers. They were living in the same house, but they never spoke to each other. They had come to the place that they never spoke to each other in any shape, form, or fashion. He cooked his meals, she cooked hers. He washed his dirty dishes, she washed hers. He slept in his bedroom and she slept in hers. And that went on for years. Years. He escaped in drink, she escaped in work, and they went on their separate ways. One night I began a class in the police chief's home in Taylorsville, and this man, Tom Dyson, was the police chief's cousin. And after several weeks, all of a sudden, by the way, to the much the surprise of us all, here sat Tom Dyson in that Bible class. And I could look way down in his soul, and if I ever saw any dark black pit, it was in that man's eyes. But then after he came back the next week and the next week, and I began to see this little speck of light way deep down in his soul, and I began to see some hope in there. And he began to change. And you could just see it week after week. You could watch this light grow and grow. And then later on, by the way, one night, Ruth was there. And they weren't together. She was on one side and he was on the other. But then two or three weeks later, they were back, and here she was a seat closer. And after about 6 or 8 weeks, there they were sitting side by side in this Bible class learning about Jesus Christ and what he means to their life. Eventually, both of them became Christians. They rectified their wrongs. They got their lives in order. They began to clean up that old filthy house where they lived. He began trying to pay back all the things that he had robbed her of. She began to try to make up for all that she had done to him. One day, he took her out from work and drove outside town and drove up into the driveway of this brand new home. And he took her out of the car and walked her up to the door and said, "This is yours. This is my gift to you." And he reaffirmed his love for her. I talked with him just this past week, or not to them, but to the preacher who lives there, and he says they're still the pillars of the church here. They're just living such vibrant, victorious lives. But that's what happened when they were 45 or 50 years old. They made this change. And I don't believe it's ever too late to change. You know where the real issue lies? The real issue was asked by a young man in the feedback class this morning. He said this. He said, "What is the one key ingredient that makes a home successful?" And we all thought a moment and we said this. The one key ingredient is when both husband and wife are totally dedicated and surrendered to Jesus Christ. It's when they each want the mind of Christ to be their mind more than they want anything else in all the world. When you get that ingredient in a home, you cannot help but have just exactly what God wants. Is Christ the head of your home? It's never too late, but you're not going to have better homes until you have better people. You're not going to have a better marriage until you become a better person. I'm not going to have a better marriage until I and my wife become better people. When that happens, our marriage will improve. Oh, I wish for us all a solid and stable and satisfying and super marriage and a beautiful home to the glory of God. We're going to sing this song that was sung at the first service without our knowing how appropriate it was. It's going to be a song of commitment. Lord Jesus, I long to be perfectly whole. And I want us to think about it in terms of our marriages and our families this morning as we commit ourselves to each other. And if you're sitting beside your wife or your husband, reach out and touch him as we stand and sing, and let's make this a commitment to each other that we're going to be the kind of people we ought to be in order to have the kind of homes we ought to have. Let us stand and sing.
Lord Jesus, I long to be perfectly whole. I want thee forever to live.